Our next case, 09-1974, State of Ohio versus Lambert Dealer. Mr. Mackey.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Associate Justices, Ms. DeVico, Mr. Lieberman. May it please the Court, my name is Jay Mackey, appearing on behalf of Lambert Dealer. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This Court accepted jurisdiction over Mr. Dealer's pro se challenge to his Senate Bill 10 reclassification after it decided State versus Bodike. In light of Bodike, however, Mr. Dealer's case essentially presents two questions. And I think the first one is far more important. And the first question is how far does State versus Bodike reach? As I'm sure Mr. Lieberman will be able to tell you a little bit about this when he speaks, there has been some dispute, as this Court is aware of, how far State versus Bodike reaches. There was a reconsideration modification motion filed in light of the Bodike decision, and essentially Mr. Dealer's case is one of the three types of cases identified in that motion that would have been reached by Bodike but for the dispute we have today.
Counsel, if we find in the previous case that any application is retroactive application or application anyone who committed a crime before is unconstitutional, does that resolve the issue here?
That's certainly one way to resolve this case. The two issues that are presented here, and the ex post facto issue, the retroactivity issue, those were presented by Mr. Dealer in his memorandum in support of jurisdiction.
The ex post facto issue would apply whether it was a court done reclassification by the Attorney General or it was by operation of law reclassification by Attorney General.
That's correct. And Mr. Dealer did not have, in his case, to give you a little bit of background, Mr. Dealer never had a House Bill 180 hearing. He was convicted prior to Megan's Law being enacted by the state of Ohio. He was sent to prison and has remained there.
Mr. Mackey, could you address the standing issue that was raised by the Attorney General's office that Mr. Dealer is going to be – he's not eligible for parole until he'd be 114 years old?
And that is true, Your Honor. Because we did not represent Mr. Dealer at the time this court took his case, we determined that certainly there's a standing question there. But we didn't address it based upon the fact that we felt that the court had asked us to represent Mr. Dealer and asked us to represent these issues. If this court were to determine that Mr. Dealer, because he's not going to be released from prison anytime soon, will not be able to address these issues, I think another case will then arise where the court will have to address these issues. So I think that essentially it's sort of a capable of repetition yet evading review argument in response. This is one of the things that the court needs to address. The question really, or at least the first question, is whether the separation of powers holding in State versus Bodike applies to Mr. Dealer. The rationale in that decision applied only to previously those offenders who were previously adjudicated by judges under Megan's Law. But the remedy, which was severance, was much broader and applied both to those who were previously adjudicated by judges, those who were adjudicated by operation of law, and then there are some other classifications of groups who it may or may not apply to, those whose convictions arose out of state, those who, for some reason or another, a judge, even after House Bill 180, did not hold a Megan's Law hearing. Our position is that, particularly in light and viewed in light of this court's recent decision in State versus Hodge, the severance remedy adopted in Bodike applies to Mr. Dealer, and it applies to those like him. This court in Hodge enunciated the decision that, in footnote 6 of Hodge, discussing severance, This court held that we do not imply that the legal effect of a judicial decision severing a statutory provision from the remainder of the statute is to actually repeal the invalid statutory language, but that a statutory provision that is held to be legally invalid becomes definitively unenforceable. And essentially, that is what we are claiming in relation to Mr. Deller and those like him. Additionally, there is a second argument that was presented in Mr. Deller's case that Mr. Liebert and I were here arguing in November of 2008 regarding the right to counsel at Senate Bill 10 classification proceedings. In that case, Shinaki versus Cordray, this court decided that case on the basis of Bodike and therefore did not reach the question related to right to counsel. Again, we would suggest that because Mr. Deller's case can be decided on the basis of Bodike or, in fact, decided on the basis of this court's decision in State versus Williams, it may not be necessary for this court to reach that right to counsel question. But certainly I'd be willing to talk about it if anyone has any questions about it. Other than that, I'd like to reserve the balance for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. DeVico.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court, my name is Dina DeVico, and I represent the State of Ohio. I will be sharing time with Attorney David Lieberman from the Ohio Attorney General's Office. I would like to split that time evenly, please. Lambert Deller raised several constitutional issues in his appeal, namely that the Ohio Adam Walsh Act violates the separation of powers, retroactivity, ex post facto, and double jeopardy clauses of the Ohio and United States constitutions. He also claims that he is entitled to court-appointed counsel for his sex offender classification challenge hearing. However, the state contends that this law is constitutional as applied to Mr. Deller and that he has failed to overcome the strong presumption of constitutionality that this law enjoys. Specifically, the state contends that in regards to the separation of powers issue, Mr. Deller has failed to show how this law or how this holding applied to him specifically. The state contends that he was never the subject of a final judicial order, and clearly this court held in Bodike that only those sex offenders who were the subject of final judicial orders classifying them under Megan's Law violated the separation of powers clause. Here he was never the subject of the final judicial order, and as such, Bodike does not apply to him. In regards to the remedy that this court structured in Bodike, the severance remedy that Mr. Mackey has already mentioned, the state feels that the application to Mr. Bodike does not lead to severance in this matter. He was never the subject of the final judicial order, and that was the only particular application that this court actually held in Bodike. And
so how would it work for him under your view?
I'm sorry.
How would the Senate Bill 10 work for him under your view?
He was classified as a Tier 3 sex offender under Senate Bill 10. I'm sorry?
Simply by the Attorney General then?
Yes.
Can do
yes,
this?
As a matter of the Attorney General notifying him pursuant to Senate Bill 10. And he was convicted of rape in 1992, and under 2950.01, he automatically became a Tier 3 sex offender. He was never the state takes the position that he was never classified as a sexually oriented offender at all under Megan's Law, so therefore he automatically becomes the Tier 3 sex offender.
So then if we would declare this to be a punitive measure, the classification, that would then result in a declaration that Senate Bill 10 could not be applied to Mr. Deller, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then how would he, if he could, be classified at that point?
He would fall under the 1963 law that was in place when he was actually convicted in 1992.
So there is no classification requirement for this defendant or any similarly situated defendants?
Well, in Mr. Deller's case, he actually was convicted of two separate sexual offenses in Cuyahoga County, so he actually would have become an habitual sex offender under the 1963 law, but no, not under Megan's law.
Okay, so he has that classification under 1963. Is it a moot subject because chances are he's not going to be in anyone's neighborhood soon?
It is true that he will not be. He is not scheduled for his first parole hearing until he is 114 years old. However, this court did lift the stay after Bodike, and it asked the parties to brief the matter. So the state feels that this court at least would be willing to consider Mr. Deller's contentions.
And whatever we decide may apply to somebody who is going to get out.
That is true, Your Honor. I believe that there are other cases being stayed for Mr. Deller's case. This court already addressed, or I'm sorry, the parties already addressed ex post facto and retroactivity quite a bit, so the state will turn to Mr. Deller's right to court-appointed counsel. He also raised this issue, and this was not raised in Williams. And the state feels that he is not entitled to court-appointed counsel for his sex offender classification challenge hearing. There is no criminal penalty, as we feel, under ex post facto or retroactivity. And there is also no fundamental right here, and there is no liberty interest here. So the state feels that he would not be entitled to court-appointed counsel at this hearing.
If
we determine that it is part of the sentencing package, that becomes a moot issue because the defendant is going to be notified as a consequence of this particular offense. These are the things that are required of you, which, I mean, right now the probation or community control puts an individual under the control of the court with conditions. These registration conditions in Senate Bill 10 are all consequences of an offense, correct?
They are, Your Honor, but they were also consequences of a criminal offense under Megan's law as well, and this court upheld Megan's law Cook.
We're looking at this particular issue, in this particular Adam Walsh Act.
Correct.
The idea of a continuum of sanctions. In Senate Bill 2, in Ohio, we have said, you have a panoply, or the judge has a group of sanctions that may be imposed on an individual. Some are mandatory according to the law, and I guess the registration requirements that we're talking about here are part of that, just as they were in the Megan's Law. But they are part of the punishment that is imposed upon the defendant.
Your Honor, the state takes the position that they are not necessarily part of the punishment itself. It is required as part of the sentence merely for ease of giving the sex offender what he needs to do, letting him know what he needs to do. And this is the best time to hold this colloquy where he can, ask questions of the judge of what he needs to do. It doesn't necessarily become a part of the sentence.
How does it differ from the old probation, where if an individual did not follow through with the conditions, there was the possibility of a new charge being filed, as there is here, mm-hmm. for violation of the requirements and new punishment? How does it differ from probation?
Your Honor, it differs from probation because it does not put in any actual specific restraints on Mr. Deller other than his registration, which this court held was remedial. All the other restraints are placed on the sheriff to put the information on the internet or to advise the community. And it does not actually place any restraints on him other than his actual registration. And also, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
These are applied by operation of law, are they not? It's not a judge's discretion. It's automatically applied. And at sentencing, the judge merely gives the individual notice that he has to comply with these requirements of law.
Correct.
But isn't something the judge monitors? It is not something that the judge has discretion about. It just happens as a matter of law, and these defendants just getting notice because it's convenient to do it at that point to make sure that he gets notice. Is that not?
That is true, Your Honor. And also for a probation violation, the offender would be brought back to that court for an additional sentence. However, if the offender violated his sex offender registration, he would then have institution of new proceedings, and it does not go back to his old conviction. It would be an entirely new proceedings, at which time he would be entitled to counsel.
Is there a right to counsel implication if the court would determine that these sanctions have become criminal? In other words, if the change from the law from Cook up until this case, what implication do you see as to the right of counsel if that would be a determination of the court?
If this court were to determine that it was a criminal matter, he wouldn't be sentenced under the Adam Walsh Act, so he wouldn't need to challenge the classification anyway, so he wouldn't need an attorney.
Okay. But going forward, then, of course, one would be entitled to an attorney because it becomes a criminal matter. Is that not,
yes.
That's the implication, right?
It would be a new criminal offense, and then he would be entitled to an attorney at that time.
But you've got an attorney.
I'm sorry?
But he has an attorney at that point.
He would have an attorney.
He's standing in front of the judge. He's got an attorney, or he's waived the right to counsel, right?
At sentencing, or I'm
yes.
sorry?
Yes.
At sentencing, he does have counsel there as well. Yes. That's only for those offenders who received their Senate Bill 10 classification as a part of sentencing. Mr. Deller did not receive
yes.
that.
We understand that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lieberman, you've got about 4 minutes and 50 seconds. You always seem to be getting shortchanged
yes.
here.
Yes, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Let me start off with the exchange that Justice Lanzinger prompted with Ms. DeVico, that, yes, there are back-end criminal penalties if somebody fails to register or violate some other registration duty, but that's been the case. That was the case in Megan's Law. That was the case going back to the old 1963 law. And, indeed, a lot of our civil laws have back-end criminal penalties, and I think from Your Honor's experience, other judicial experiences like civil protection orders, we tell people they have to go to certain places or can't go to certain places, and if they fail or if they violate that order, the prosecutor can bring a separate criminal charge, and that individual will face a separate criminal proceeding and possible sanctions. Now, let me.
So basically, your argument here is it's not going to cross the line into a criminal sanction because the additional requirements are not onerous or burdensome or meet the criterion that was set up and, you know, considered in the Kellogg case. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that case.
Not the Kellogg.
Cook or Smith versus Doe. There's so many of them. But I think the additional point is that many of these requirements are very much mirror the old Megan's Law provisions. I don't want to repeat the last argument too much as to the specific argument about Bodike. Mr. Deller does not fall within the four corners of this court's holding in Bodike because he never received a classification from a judge. And this his classification does not violate the severance remedy of Bodike because I think the court was quite clear in that case that it was only speaking to the legal issue in front of it. And that is consistent with this court's well-established tradition of restraint and not reaching out to decide the next case that perhaps could be in the pipeline.
All right. I misspoke when I said the Kellogg was the Kennedy analysis.
Yes, yes.
And if this court engages in that analysis, as we, I think, will do for the Williams case, and obviously you would agree that that will control this case?
Yes. A rare point of agreement among everybody in the room that if Mr. Williams prevails on either his ex post facto or his retroactivity clause challenge, this case would become moot because Mr. Deller would be able to seek relief under the same types of theories.
And if we decide against Mr. Williams' argument and maintain this as a remedial civil remedy, we don't need to consider right of counsel?
No, I think you would. If the state wins in the Williams case, the two live issues for this court would be the Bodike separation of powers challenge that Mr. Deller is raising. And if that fails, we would get to the final end, the right to counsel claim. And now,
those arguments would be significantly diminished if we find that this is still a civil penalty.
Absolutely, Your Honor. As to the Bodike case. I had the pleasure of standing up here in Bodike, and the appellants in that case were raising a very narrow proposition of law. Actually, a proposition of law number 3, it was very tailored. Application of Senate Bill 10 to offenders previously adjudicated by judges under Megan's law violates separation of powers. And so, quite rightly, Mr. Deller does not fall within the proposition
but
that...
Wouldn't the logic of it just naturally extend to this individual as well? Because while Megan's law didn't exist, he was previously adjudicated under the operative law that was in place at the time by a judge and told the four corners of what his sentence was that he was going to serve. So doesn't the fundamental building block of Bodike apply to him as well? It's just a different criminal statutory scheme was in place at the time.
There could be a scenario where somebody even pre-Megan's law could fit within the Bodike decision if they can show that there was a judicial adjudication of his sex offender status. The record in this case suggests that there was no adjudication of that status, and for good reason. Under that old law, the judge had no involvement in the sex offender classification. It was attached automatically by operation of law.
So you have the anomaly, then, if we find in your direction on the remaining two issues that somebody who had a court-adjudicated decision is not subject to Senate Bill 10, and somebody who had a lesser classification by operation of law is subject to the harsher restrictions of Senate Bill 10.
I'm not sure that it's that anomalous. Excuse me, Your Honor. It's simply they're two differently situated individuals.
Isn't there an equal protection argument of some sort?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, they're not similarly situated because one person brought a claim, went it through a judge, and the judge classified him or her under the law. The other person did it. And in my experience,
he had a lesser classification, and now he's getting a much more severe classification by operation of Senate Bill 10, whereas if he was fortunate enough to be in a little higher group and get an education, he doesn't.
I think the distinction here is Bodike, that if the one offender in the first offender that you talk about sought relief or was part of the Bodike class of individuals and maintained relief or secured relief from this court, I'm not aware of any judicial decision where an equal protection clause is created when a court gives a certain class of offenders relief and that does not apply to another class of offenders. Your Honor, I'm over my time again.
Yes, so you are, Mr. Lieberman.
Thank you for the court's indulgence.
Thank you. Mr. Mackey, you have about 9.5 minutes. Don't feel that you have to use all of it.
I certainly won't waste your time. I do want to address, however, I think there's a little bit of confusion about the reach of Bodike. The remedy chosen by the court, the severance remedy chosen by the court, reaches out far beyond the question of whether or not there was a judicial adjudication. And that can be shown, as a matter of fact, by a number of the cases that were decided by this court in the In Re sex offender classification cases decided on the basis of Bodike. A number of those cases, there was no judicial adjudication. There were simply became sexually oriented offenders by operational law. No hearing was held. Additionally, a number of those offenders were from out of state. Now,
those are summary decisions, though, right? There was no analysis, no opinion on those.
That's correct. There's certainly summary.
Could have been decided for lots of reasons.
That is true, Your Honor. It could easily have been that way. And I don't mean to...
No, I understand. Just a clarification.
However, I guess what they do is what those decisions do is create at least a certain interpretation of what was going on with the Bodike remedy as opposed to the rationale. This court chose severance as the remedy. And in Hodge, this court said it only chooses severance when a specific part of a statute is definitively unenforceable. I guess our position is that the Bodike remedy controls here. It goes further than the rationale. There's no doubt about that. It does go further.
But you're saying that our declaration about the section of the statute that we found violative takes it out in application to all defendants, not just those similarly situated to the Bodike defendant.
I'm not sure I follow, Your Honor.
Well, the part of the statute that we found to be offensive in the Bodike, and we struck it down.
Yes. Just,
okay. So you're saying because it was struck down in Bodike, it's struck down for every application.
And that statute, the only statutes that were severed by the court were the statutes that permitted the Attorney General to engage in administrative reclassification. Mm-hmm. That was it. That was all that was taken.
Okay. So you're saying because that was excised in Bodike, that none of those classifications will be valid?
That's correct.
Okay.
Those administrative reclassifications. Again, as we've talked about, going forward, this will be Senate Bill 10 is valid and is part of the punishment going forward for offenses that occurred after its effective date or, depending on how this court resolves Williams, offenses that occurred. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mr. Mackey, when you said reclassification, you emphasized that word reclassification by the Attorney General being offensive. That also includes initial classification. Would you not agree?
And it does. It does, Your Honor. And our position, and as a matter of fact, interestingly, at the oral argument at Bodike, it was the Attorney General's position that State versus Hayden controlled those offenders who were incarcerated prior to the effective date of Senate Bill 10, that those people were automatically classified under Megan's Law by operational law pursuant to that case. And that's certainly our position now. We're not suggesting, for instance, and I want to be clear, we're not suggesting that Mr. Deller has no duty to report upon his release, whenever that may be.
You're not claiming that now.
We are not claiming that. Well, we're not claiming that now. And what we are claiming now is that
14 years.
but you're saying that it's the judge at the time of sentencing who is going to do this, who is going to impose the registration requirements.
Well, in this case, we say that he had a Megan's Law duty pursuant to Revised Code 1.58, and that if for instance there was some decision that perhaps he should be a sexual predator, and the facts here may well warrant a sexual predator hearing on that point. Because of State versus Hayden, they could go back. They could have a sexual predator classification proceeding for Mr. Deller and those like him.
Okay.
I won't waste any more of your time, Your Honor.
You're not wasting our time. Thank you very much. All right, gentlemen and Ms. DeVico, we will take the matter under advisement, and you will be informed of our decision. Thank you very much. We will now take a recess.